a lot of entities do an inventory of all of their buildings, and but an inventory isn't a plan either. It's just an inventory. If it doesn't say how it's going to get fixed, when it's going to get fixed, and who's responsible for getting it fixed, then it's not a plan.
Well, hello and welcome to the ADA Shop Talk podcast. I'm your host, Paul Klein. And if you are an ADA coordinator, government official, architect, or accessibility specialist trying to better understand the ADA, then you are in the right place. The ADA Shop Talk podcast is brought to you by BlueDag. Check out BlueDag's transition plan builder and inspection suite over at bluedag.com. And I've been working on getting some great guests, and this is someone special to me because she's been someone I've worked with in the past and worked for, and just an all-around good person, and that is Christy Avalos with Accessology. She is the president and CEO. She's been doing this for over 40 years, and she is my go-to PSA person. Christy, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. I'm glad you're able to get with me on a Friday. I know you're busy running a company and you've got all kinds of projects going, but I think our guests are going to really enjoy hearing from you because you got such a great handle on this. I know you call, I think you call it the soft side of ADA, which I just love that term, the PSA, and you've worked with a lot of government entities in helping them with their transition plans and everything, But I want to get your take on that. But tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into this whole world of ADA consulting and transition plans? And go back to how you got into all this for our listeners.
Sure, and thanks for having me on, Paul. I appreciate it. Back in 1977, I was working at a convalescent home for children, which was a place that that kids with disabilities lived, most of them Monday through Friday while their parents worked, and their parents picked them up on the weekends, and some of them had been dropped off and had never been picked up again. And so I was working there, and these were kids, and they had hopes and dreams and goals and desires just like everybody else, and they were trapped in this institution. And a little boy told me, one of the little boys there who had muscular dystrophy, told me in a conversation that he had really hoped that that he could be a professional football player. But of course, he knew that wasn't going to happen because he had muscular dystrophy. And there was something about that statement that just kind of stabbed me in the heart. And that day, and there were a couple other things that happened that day, but that day I just felt like my purpose was to remove barriers for people with disabilities. And I've done it ever since. I didn't know what it meant in 1977. You know, at the time I went out and I read books into cassette tapes for people who were blind, and I learned basic sign language so I could teach it to kids who were deaf. And I didn't really know what it meant until several years later, but I've just always had a passion for people with disabilities.
Yeah, that's for sure. And now I know you had I wasn't aware of that far back, and that was great, but I know you had a stint or you helped, didn't you help American Airlines or an airline with their disability initiatives at one point?
Yeah, I worked for American Airlines when I started with American Airlines in 1982. So because they knew my passion for people with disabilities, when it came time to participate in the airline version of ADA, which is the Air Carrier Access Act, I was put on that team, and I did a lot of the interaction with the Department of Transportation and the ATA. And we wrote their carrier plan because that's a requirement under the Air Carrier Access Act. Each airline had to have its own carrier plan. So we wrote the carrier plan, and then we trained all 70,000 American Airlines employees system-wide.
Wow.
on how to best serve people with disabilities. So we wrote the training as well.
Yeah, that's great. No, and that was long before the ADA and everything came along. So I know you're a sweet spot since then, and having worked with you over the last few years on some projects and so forth, we'll just leave it at that. But, you work with a lot of Title II entities. We have a lot of ADA coordinators and, government agencies that are trying to implement their their Title II obligation. But if you could kind of talk about the transition plan process, as well as the difference between like facility assessments and what, you know, you refer to as PSA. I love that term because it summarizes kind of the two I don't know, just kind of riff a little bit on that for our listeners. Cause I think you break it down in such a easy to understand way. And I just love the way you explain that, but you know, facility assessments versus PSA in the Title II environment.
Sure. So there's actually, in my opinion, there's four parts to a transition plan. There's the buildings, there's the parks for most entities, there's the sidewalks and exterior routes, and then there's what I refer to as the PSA, which is the program services and activities. So the bottom line is an entity has to evaluate everything that they have and everything that they do, in order to make sure that what they have works for everybody and what they do includes everybody. And so that's what the evaluation is part. So when it says self-evaluation and transition plan, the transition plan is the facilities. The self-evaluation is all of what I like to refer to as the soft side, or the program services and activities. Now, ADA isn't the law that says you have to have anything. It doesn't say you have to have sidewalks. It says if you have it, it then has to work for everybody. Mm. And the same is true with PSA. They're not coming in and telling you have to have this program or you have to have that program. They're saying with the program that you offer, it has to be fully compliant.
Right.
And there's a lot of programs that are offered that people don't think about. They don't realize that there's an interaction that they have to think about, or maybe a step they have to take to make it more compliant.
Right. Right. And I think that's where a lot of, like, especially new ADA coordinators and people in the government entities, everybody's so quick to go to the built environment and go, okay, let's fix this ramp, this parking stall. Let's upgrade the bathroom in City Hall. And then they don't look at their PSA and go, wait a minute, the higher use areas are the rec center where all the disabled people go every day that doesn't have any parking stalls, yet they're so focused on something else. Is that a fair way to say that?
It is. It is. And I attribute that to entities not really knowing what they need. So we started an interim step before an entity actually starts their transition plan. I think one of the biggest mistakes they make is they go right out to an RFP and they don't know what they need.
Right.
If they don't know what they need, I assure you a consultant's not going to know what they need. So there has to be an interim step. And we call the interim step a compliance plan, or a plan to do a plan. And what we do in that interim step is we take a look at what have you done over the last 34 years. You've done stuff. What buildings have already been evaluated? Which ones are new? Which ones are you going to tear down in a few years? So it doesn't make sense to spend money on those. You know, let's figure out where you are and what's been done. Then when you go out to the RFP is very specific as to what you need. Because if you just say we need a transition plan, well, you may have 500 buildings on your list of buildings. But once we pare through the list, you may only need to evaluate 420 of them. Mm-hmm. That's a big price difference.
Yeah.
So if you just send out an RFP and say, okay, we have 500 buildings and we have all of this, you're going to get pricing from here to here, because you're going to get different levels of knowledge of what you need. And then you're going to go with a low bid. You're not going to get what you think you're going to get.
Right.
So that interim step helps you know, okay, so we've already got, you know, we've knocked this building off. We've knocked this building off. We have X number of buildings that are historical in nature. So we know that we're going to have to spend some additional time on those. We have X number of buildings that nobody goes in. They're storage buildings, they're pump stations, they're things that don't have to be evaluated. So now we've just gotten that list down from whatever it was to the actual number that needs to be evaluated. And that alone has just saved hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially.
Yeah.
Do the same thing with the PSA. You have decisions that you have to make. So for instance, your job descriptions have to be looked at. We have to make sure that the job description itself is set up in a way that a person with a disability can disqualify themselves. They don't want us looking at somebody going, yeah, I don't think you can do this job. But if we say that the essential job functions are such that, and somebody cannot complete those essential job functions, then they don't qualify for the job.
Right.
So if in the job description it says must be able to lift 50 pounds above 27 inches on a regular basis, and somebody just had spine surgery, they know they can't do that. They know they don't qualify for that job.
Right.
And so the other thing that we want to do is remove discriminatory language. So, for instance, we used to say must be able to type 50 words a minute. Well, now we have voice input. Maybe they can't type at all, but they can still input 50 words a minute, which means they can complete the essential job function.
Right.
So, all the job descriptions have to be looked at some point, but the entity has to decide, do we want to do that internally? Do we want our, HR department to do that? Do we want to have a consultant look at every single one of them? Do we want to have a consultant maybe look at a percentage of them and then teach us what to do on the rest of them? Those are all different pricing. And so, if in that first phase we're making those decisions, then when the RFP goes out, you're able to be very clear on what it is that you need. We've already talked through it, we've already set it up so that you know what you need. And
Yeah.
it's going to make the process go much smoother.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's more of a tailored plan to that specific entity. And I think that's so much more helpful and money well invested. And to dovetail a little more on the PSA side, you gave some great examples with the employment application, but talk some more about the PSA side. What are some other examples? I know, there's some large counties that I'm aware of the Northwest that we worked with you on and others in the South and in Texas area and so forth. But what are some other examples of the PSA review process that you do with Accessology?
Okay, well, here's an interesting one. We had an entity call, and this wasn't while we were doing an evaluation. They just kind of called out of the blue and they said, I wonder if you can help us. We have a problem. We have a little girl who has autism, and her parents sent her to summer camp, and she was there for 3 weeks, and they did animal interaction there. And she fell in love with a baby goat. And I'm going, okay. And they said, well, as long as that goat was by her side, she performed better. She was less agitated. She was more inclusive. And so at the end of the 3 weeks, they gave her the baby goat. I'm going, okay. And well, we have an ordinance that says you can't have farm animals in our in the residential housing. And I
Oh.
went, oh, okay. So we bend that ordinance for this particular purpose. And they go, well, aren't we setting a precedent? And I'm like, well, first of all, not everybody wants a baby goat. So let's not worry about the precedent. But what you need to do is you need to have a process in place. So whether it's the ADA liaison team that we create as part of the development of the transition plan process, or you set aside another committee that reviews the ordinance and reviews the purpose and makes a decision that allows a person with a disability to have, a service animal, which essentially this is a comfort animal or a, there's a big difference between a service animal and a comfort animal. But this is an emotional support or a comfort animal, which we have to allow in the homes. And so once it goes through a committee, then the next time somebody comes in and goes, she got a goat, I want a chicken, you can say, well, she qualified under this program and
Right.
you don't. So it's thinking about things like that before they happen.
Right.
Another example is we had a small town that had a program that they called Breakfast with the Mayor. So once a month, the mayor would have breakfast in one of their community's restaurants, and anybody who wanted to go could go. And sometimes there were four people, and sometimes there were 40. And this particular day, there was a little girl who happened to use a wheelchair who was they were going to give her an award, and they said, come to the Breakfast with the Mayor. We'll do the award there. We'll call the media and all of that. Nobody stopped to think about the two steps that were in front of that restaurant. So this little girl shows up in her wheelchair and she can't get into the restaurant. And guess what the story was about?
Little
Because the
girl not
media was
getting in the
there.
restaurant.
Right, exactly. And so if they had a process in place that has a checklist for basic accessibility, then in their mayor program, they could say, you will only qualify for us to have breakfast with a mayor in your restaurant if you meet this basic accessibility list. If they don't meet that list, then they don't get chosen. The city can't use it. And that also encourages the local Title III entities to come into compliance as well, so that they can be part of the programs that are offered. So it's things like that that people just don't think about.
Now that's an excellent example, because that's a great one that crosses the divide of the politicians and the decision makers that don't like to, in general, I'm talking in generalities, don't like to deal with the ADA because it's not flashy and sexy and doesn't, you know, the only time it gets media is when it's a negative. It rarely gets a positive. Even when, a city does really great on their barrier removal or you know, disability initiatives, the press just isn't, it doesn't sell papers as much. I mean, I guess that's in general in news period. Nothing positive generally sells. It's always the negative, unfortunately. But
to your leads, it leads.
Yeah, but to your point, if the politicians understand that nexus and how they can avoid some severe mud in their face and political fallout by having that part of their program and service assessment, that's a great thing. And that's what I think you guys do really, really well. And talk about a little bit about your experience with entities that have a lot, how do I say this? There's a lot of entities out there. I can't remember the number of how many Title II entities there are out there, and only a certain percentage has actually embarked on their self-evaluation and transition plan process. But for those that don't do that or haven't done that, what are some of the ramifications, if you will, of the DOJ or what happens in that process that you've seen when the feds get involved because of an entity's lack of compliance?
Good question, Paul. Here's what a lot of people aren't, a lot more are becoming aware of, but a lot still are not aware of. In 2000, let me see, it was 2010. It was at the 20th anniversary of the signing of ADA. The federal agencies basically recommitted to the ADA, and their kind of come from was, well, you've had 20 years. You've had 20 years to get things into compliance, and you still haven't done it. So now we're going to start going after you from the only leverage we have, which is funding, right? Most Title II entities get state or federal funding for their, from Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior. They get all of these grants or this funding. And so the federal agencies kind of said, we're going to withhold funding if people don't get their transition plans in place. Now, when they said it in 2010, they didn't really have the program set up yet. So we didn't start seeing any action until about 2014. So here's how that generally works. One of the federal agencies, and it started with the Department of Transportation, and it was a program through the Federal Highway Administration, where they would send out a letter to the State Department of Transportation that said, we want to see your transition plan by blank. Okay, so if they got it in January of 24, they might say, we want to see your transition plan by January or by December of 25. Okay, so that gives them 2 years to kind of pull it all together and get their transition plan in place. And then you need to assure that your subrecipients have their transition in place by December of 26, or they will no longer be eligible for our money. So the federal government is saying you can't give our money to your subrecipients if they don't have a transition plan in place.
I see.
So that started with the Federal Highway Administration. We've seen now almost every federal agency, if you apply for a grant, there's a box that you have to check that says we have a current and comprehensive ADA transition plan. So a current means it's less than 4 years old, and comprehensive means it covers everything. So I've seen agencies pay $250,000 for a 12-page document. I assure you, a transition plan is going to be this thick.
You're right, 12 inches thick at least.
Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, one of our clients, when we finished the transition plan, she printed it all out and took it to a city council meeting and she weighed it. It was 11 and a half pounds and she called it her 11 and a half pound baby. And what she was trying to convince to their local city council is that one person can't implement it. This is a big deal. It's everything we do and it's everything that we have. And we need to put the resources into it to make sure that we are fully compliant. Because quite honestly, it's been 34 years. There's very little defense at this point.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure. And when you say a when they say a comprehensive self-evaluation transition plan, it's fair to say that is facility assessments as well as the PSA, not just the facility assessments. Because I think a lot of people just go look at their facilities and then totally forget about the PSA side.
Yes. And that's absolutely true. It's not a transition plan unless it has all of the requirements, which is going to be facilities, exterior routes or public rights of way, parks, and your PSA. And if you don't have all of those, then it's really not a comprehensive plan.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And do you remember the number? Wasn't it like 20 something thousand entities in the United States are supposed to have that, a transition plan and a self-evaluation plan?
Well, I don't have the exact number, but I can tell you that it's every city, every county, every state agency, every school district, every university, any entity that receives public funding and is governed by a board is considered Title II, and every Title II entity is required to have a transition plan.
Yeah.
Okay, so sometimes we'll have something like I just got back last night from doing a stadium. It is a stadium that has $220 million going in. 220, yeah, $220 million, I believe it is. And the point is, some of the money is public, some of the money is local, some of the money is private. So they still, when you're spending that kind of money, you still have to ensure that you have full compliance.
Yeah.
And entities seem to think that there's a radar that they can get under. Small towns go, oh, well, we're grandfathered. Well, there's nobody grandfathered under the ADA.
Right.
A lot of entities do an inventory of all of their buildings, but an inventory isn't a plan either. It's just an inventory. If it doesn't say how it's going to get fixed, when it's going to get fixed, and who's responsible for getting it fixed, then it's not a plan. So there's a lot of things out there that are information about the city or about the entity, but it's not a plan. And it's not going to get you what you need to have if the Department of Justice comes looking.
Right. Yeah, once they come knocking on the door, you want to have your all your ducks in order. It's like getting audited for taxes. You know, you better have
Yeah, exactly.
all your books in order. You can't go manufactured after the fact. So no, that's super helpful. And I think there's a lot of misunderstandings there, you know, with a lot of our listeners and people who work in Title II entities. And talk a little bit about the accessology process. I love how you explain the level of detail, whether it's a facility assessment. There's like three different levels of detail that you can provide, even with PSA. And so talk about how the level of detail, because I think a lot of consultants will just say, okay, it's $200,000, we'll do everything. But accessology is different because you offer your clients a level of detail which allows some different ways of doing it. And I'll let you explain that.
Sure. So every entity is different. And the plan that we're creating is your plan. So therefore, we feel it's important to do it your way. So for instance, some entities want, they just want to know if the curb ramp complies or not. Because if it doesn't comply, they're going to have to tear it out and redo it. So they don't want to know every level of detail of the slope and the cross slope and the flares and all of the measurements that we take. So if we're just checking a yes or no, this one needs to be replaced or not, that's a whole lot cheaper than if we're measuring the width and the slopes and all of that. And some people want all of that detail. And some entities will say, well, if we can fix it instead of replace it, then we need to know what's wrong with it, what we're going to have to fix. So they want the detail. Those are different pricing. Okay. We could go into a building and we can say, okay, I see some round doorknobs. You're going to have to replace all of those. That's one level of detail. Or we can say you've got 11 doorknobs on the fourth floor, and you've got 9 on the third floor, and you've got 7 on the second floor, and you've got 12 on the first floor. That's a different level of detail. Or we can go in and we could say door 101, here's everything that's wrong with it. Door 102, here's everything that's wrong with it. And do each door individually, and that's a third level of detail. So those are all different pricing. And again, it's your plan. So we want to do it your way. But the important thing is if you have just gone out for an RFP, what you want to do is understand what you're going to get. If they're charging this much and they're giving you this service, that's not going to be a good deal for you. So again, that's one of the reasons we started doing the compliance plans, was to help an entity figure out what they have so that they know what they need. And you set a compliance plan up much like you would a transition plan. So you've got the document in place, and then we just figure out where the holes are. Then your RFP basically is going to fill those holes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And when it comes to the remediation and the implementation side, have you seen any examples or court cases or experience in your 40-something years of doing this? Like, what do they allow an entity to phase it in? I mean, can they remediate over time? I mean, like with corrections, I mean, you just can't go and move walls around in an old prison. That's a clear program. I mean, they can make some alternate programmatic allowances in the meantime, but kind of explain that remediation allowance. I mean, does it all have to be done like on day one, as soon as you know about it, or is there an opportunity to phase it in? I mean, how does that process work that you've seen?
It's going to be different for different entities. The goal is that it is reasonable for the entity. Okay. You don't know if it's going to be reasonable until we know what it's going
What
to
it
cost to
is.
fix everything. So the transition plan is the document that tells you what it's going to cost to fix everything. So if you haven't even done the plan, then you don't know what it's going to cost. Now, again, keep in mind, we're 34 years into this. These plans were supposed to be completed by 1993. We have a lot of entities now that go, well, we did one in 93. And have you implemented it? Have you done anything with it? Could you find it? Can you even find it
it's
at this
probably a
point?
binder with a bunch of dust on it in the Public Works Department basement.
Exactly. And that's and then when they realize that they can't find it, that's a whole other problem, because obviously it's not a plan if you're not using it. A transition plan should be a living document. Okay, so when it comes to figuring it out, if we do all of the evaluations and we determine it's going to be $1 million to fix everything, well, then 20 years is probably too long. If it's going to be $40 million to fix everything, 20 years may not be long enough. So first we have to get to that number, and that's what the evaluations are for. What is it going to cost to bring everything into compliance? Then we have to set it up in a way that is reasonable for the entity. So, for instance, if you're a larger entity and you tell me that you're able to bring everything in, or that you're able to spend $1 million a year, let's say that's what we put into the plan. And we get to the end of the first year and you've only spent $750,000. So year two, you might say, okay, well, let's try to do the 1.25 million this year. And you get to the end of the second year and you've only done 750,000. Well, then that's your number. That's a number we know you can hit. So let's redo the plan at 750,000 a year and take it out as long as necessary. As long as it is reasonable for the entity, it's going to it's going to work. Now, I've seen where it was just a totally unreasonable number. As a matter of fact, in one of the legal cases, in writing, They said they were going to do three curb ramps a quarter for 77 years. Well, that's not even a whole intersection.
Right.
Okay. So that's not going to be considered reasonable.
Yeah.
But I'm not the one that determines that. In that one, it was the judge that had to determine that. And sometimes it's the Department of Justice. So you have to be showing an effort. And at this point, because you've had 34 years, we need to make that effort rather aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the whole thing is, does it pass the sniff test? And the last thing you want is the DOT or the DOJ coming in and telling you how you're going to spend all your capital improvement projects for the next 5 years. I want to report every 30 days, forget the new slide or the new park you were going to build, city council. You are redirecting all funds to ADA compliance. And that is a bad place for an entity to be in.
Yeah. You can drive the bus or you can get hit by the bus, but you're much better off to drive the bus.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, all entities, they've done stuff for the last 34 years. So it doesn't look as bad as it might feel today once we bring in everything that you've already done.
Yeah.
You know, if we can capture all of that, then a plan that might have, you know, cost over $1 million may get reduced considerably because you've got stuff that's already done. You just don't know it. So we need to pull all of that together and get that process going. But the most important thing that you need to do is get started.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking credit. A lot of times Public Works is replacing curb ramps just because they're cracked or failing and they're not realizing they could actually take credit as part of their transition plan process. And there's just no nexus there. And I think your term living transition plan is so insightful. And because that's obviously what our friends at BlueDag, you know, are trying to do with the software is instead of a binder or instead of dumping it on the Public Works Department basement, you know, having that living transition plan, somewhere to track everything. Because like I say, as politicians, the ADA regulations and staff come and go, but your transition plan always has to be there. And the more you can, you know, the more you can automate that or keep it more upfront, I think is the better. And I know we're BlueDag's partnering with you on a lot of your clients and you're partnering with us. And so it's a great team that we have going there. So
I think we do.
Yeah,
I think we do. And you know, BlueDag that started out for just kind of building evaluations has been really improving for the entire transition plan experience, including the PSA part of it. And so having a single piece of software that isn't just asset management software, but it's actually developed for the purposes of creating and maintaining your transition plan, that's a unique thing.
Yeah, we're excited about a lot of the improvements and the, you know, the connectivity to ADA compliance issues with existing systems for work orders and processes through the API connections. But all that's super exciting. But I know we're up on the time here, and I don't want to spend too much time plugging BlueDag because we're trying to we want to serve our listeners in a lot of good ways here. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the organizations you work with or speak for. I know there's a great one down in Texas that I love, but I'm going to save save that because I think it's probably one of the ones you work with. But explain some of the organizations you speak at or work with in the education and ADA space.
Sure. Over the years, I do most, or I shouldn't say most, I do a lot of the annual conferences. Of course, the National ADA Symposium, I speak there every year. But I do things like AIA meetings, sometimes the national ones, sometimes they're regional ones. Organizations like PWX, for public works directors, I do a lot of large stadiums and entities like that, performance entities across the country. And I speak for the International Association of Assembly Managers, ICMA for, you know, counties. So
administrators,
municipal leagues, you know, across the country. So it just, any type of entity that represents the types of entities that need transition plans, they need guidance. There's a lot of bad information out there. And there's a lot of people happy to take their money and not give them what it is that they really need. And they don't really even know it until they end up in some type of litigation. And so our goal is to help them understand what they need so they can make good interior decisions.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I know you do a lot of pro bono or speaking for entities, agencies, organizations. If someone's listening and they'd like to have have you come on as a speaker or do like an informal like education thing, is that something that you do with Accessology or is available?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh.
We try to find any way that we can help people understand again so that they can make better decisions. So, I have no problem talking.
Well,
So.
that was a loaded question because I knew the answer, but those listening don't. So yeah, if you're interested in having Christy come out and do a workshop or an ADA information system for your politicians or your constituents or anything like that, I'll have her website and LinkedIn in the show notes and maybe the email. Is it okay if I include your email, Christy?
Sure.
Yeah, so
Sure.
you can email her and reach her out with any kind of questions on that and her services. She does a lot of speaking and just, getting the information out there because there's a lot of bad information out there. So it's always good to see people doing that and offering up their knowledge to just for the betterment of the industry. So that's much appreciated. Last question here. I wanted, we actually might have two if we got time, but I'll wrap this one up. Let's talk a little bit about the Accessibility Specialists Association in Texas. That's where I was going. I was hoping you were going to talk about that. I know you're involved in that. I just love that organization. I love their new exam. Just speak about the APA down there in Texas and some of its
Sure.
benefits.
So Texas is one of the few states that has a state requirement for plans to be reviewed and inspected on behalf of the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation. So any project that's over $50,000 in construction cost in Texas has to be reviewed and inspected. And so a number of years ago, we realized that we needed an organization that would have a voice in Texas. And so we started at the time it was called TRASA, the Texas Registered Accessibility Specialists Association. We started TRASA. I was one of the founders of it. And then as it grew, we changed the name to the Accessibility Professionals Association to include more than just Texas, to be able to bring in other people across the country that are specializing in this field. And then as it grew, another thing that we felt really strongly about was that there needed to be a certification process for people who call themselves access consultants. Because we have anybody who, calls themselves an access consultant and they may or may not really understand accessibility. And so in January of last year, we had our first test. Our first certification process test for a national certification. And that is through APAC instead of there's APA, which is the Accessibility Professionals Association. And then there's the Accessibility Professionals Association certification.
Okay.
And that's APAC. And so APAC is, I'm on the board for APAC, and APAC is. Trying to get the word out that there is now a national certification. So that at least gives buyers some kind of comfort that the person that they're hiring knows what they're doing.
Right.
A lot of places, I mean, the only places that had a state program really are Texas and California. So we'd have somebody doing an RFP in Missouri, and it says that they have to have a CASP. And a CASP is specific to California, but they
Right.
just didn't know any better. So now with the APAC through the APAC entity, people can get that national certification.
Yeah, I love that. The very first episode I did, I listed my top five certifications in this space, and that was my number one one. I love the CASP. I'm originally from California and all that, but it is specific to California, and there's a lot of California minutia in that test that's specific to the state only. And so, and you're absolutely right. And so this test is really encompassed the Fair Housing Act, the Readily Achievable Bear Removal, program access, more on a national level. And so I think that's a great, for anybody who's thinking about becoming a RAS or a CASP or just an ADA coordinator, that APAC is a great certification to get. And I'll put the link into that in the show notes. And you also go listen to episode one of this podcast. I talked a lot about in depth there, and maybe you can lean on John Torkelson for me, because I was trying to get him on the podcast, but he's having a busy spring, so he said check back with him later. But maybe a little prodding from Christy will help him come on the show. I'd love to have him on.
I'll do that.
All right.
I will do that.
Well, last question. Absolutely, last question. What is one of the biggest mistakes or learning lessons you had when applying the ADA?
I'm not sure that I completely understand the question. So I assume what you mean is what a client has had.
Well, or just even applying the codes. For example, I think when I first started, I didn't understand the readily achievable. I just thought, oh, you have to just comply, like the building code. Anyway, so it can be anything, client-based or regulatory or PSA. What was one of those light bulb moments you had over the years, maybe earlier on in your career when you were first getting into this, or even more recently, whatever?
It was when I realized that there isn't, that entities don't understand the risk. They just don't understand. When we think about things like this, we think about it from what is the least I have to do to not get sued. But the ADA calls for compliance to the maximum extent feasible. There's a big difference in those two philosophies.
Yes.
So when we have agencies that are trying to just get by and check the box, they're going to put themselves in the line of litigation way faster than somebody who is trying to do everything that they can. And so when that light bulb went off and I realized that their perspective on ADA was more, well, the government's telling me to do this, instead of what is its purpose?
Right.
You know, 1/5 of our population has or claims to have a person with a permanent disability in their home, according to the U.S. Census. That's 1/5 of our population. So it's too big of a demographic for anybody to ignore. And if we're just trying to check a box, but we don't really know what we're doing, then we're gonna miss that box.
Yeah.
So helping people understand the reason, why does the toilet have to be 18 inches from the wall? Why are the grab bars supposed to be a specific height? Why can't we have a cross slope more than 2%? Once they understand the why, they embrace it.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting it.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. And I think that's that whole good faith effort. You know, when, you know, if you're making a really good faith effort and trying to provide the greatest degree of access to the greatest number of people with the greatest number of disabilities is always better than just the minimums.
You know, every one of us, if we live a normal life expectancy, every one of us will have a disability to one degree or another at some point in our life.
That is so true. And with that, that was a great interview, Christy. I thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us and our listeners. And I'll include your email and your website and LinkedIn in the show notes, as well as the APAC certification, and you're just a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's been fun working with you over the last few years and getting to know you, and just good person, and love having you a part of my life, so it's been great.
Well, thank you, Paul. I feel the same way, and I appreciate you bringing me on.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.